Hey everyone, this is Jack doing a little impromptu recording before this episode here at the coffee shop to let you know that we have, as of a few seconds ago, launched our Patreon, and I'm not going to give you the full pitch. I'm just going to let you know that if you've ever enjoyed our podcasts, our writing, our videos, and you want to help us continue to grow, then please consider going to our website, cardboardherald.com. At the top of the page is a link to our Patreon. There's all kinds of cool rewards and ways that you can be a part of Team Cardboard Herald. So thanks so much for listening. Let's get to our episode with Tony the Bearded Rogue Miller, co-designer of Fire in the Library on Kickstarter right now. Hello and welcome back to the Cardboard Herald. As always, my chance to talk with creative gamers and game creators. And today I have the return of the lovely, the one, the only, the bearded rogue, Tony Miller. Welcome back to the show, Tony.
It's great to be back. I'm glad that I'm welcome back.
Yeah, well, you are always welcome back on the show, especially after such an exciting conversation last time. But it's kind of rare to have someone back on the show within such close proximity here. I mean, we just posted your show as of recording this a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't wait, Tony.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, well, the main reason that I wanted to have you back on is we talked about, like, life, liberty, and everything under the sun, and then kind of steered clear, for the most part, about games. We did talk about Fire in the Library and Back to Earth and some of the stuff that you were playing. I was really intrigued because you mentioned, I remember this specifically, like putting a pin in it, that Charterstone was your game of the year for 2017. I was like, I need to come back to that conversation at some point.
Yes.
But you are a games guy. Your podcast is about breaking into board games. You talk about board games, you post about board games, and then you also make board games. So I wanted to talk to you just about games in general, and that's why you're back here today, in case you didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I know now, and so we're ready to kick this off then.
Yeah, well, let's kick it off with just, what have you been playing lately that's been bringing you joy, like putting a smile on your face?
February, because of prep for the Kickstarter and various other things, Unpub coming up, I didn't play a lot of games, but I played a lot of really quality games in February and early March now. So we finished up our Charterstone campaign in February, which was a fantastic thing. I don't want to get too heavy into spoilers yet and ruin it for anybody else, but I absolutely loved it. I knew I was going to love it when we got halfway through the campaign last year, and then we finished it this year, and it's so good.
Were you playing with a full six players?
We played with four. Okay. We played with four, and we played with none of the Atoma. We didn't feel like we needed them. Mm-hmm. We considered doing it during the intro game, but the rules for running non-active charters are dead simple.
Yeah,
without totally. Having to have additional players. So we just had the four of us, and it was really, really good. There's a couple people who've kind of critiqued it that the story arc isn't very pronounced. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the story is a little bit more like backseat than some of the other legacy games like Seafall, where you're literally reading paragraphs out of a book.
Yeah.
You know, but it worked for me. Like, there was a definite thread, there was a definite story, and each game had its own little mini story in it.
Right.
Like, the objectives changed, what was going on changed, the rules changed. And so it took the very basic, like, my first worker placement game that the first game was, and added a whole bunch of interesting twists and turns throughout it. We haven't yet, but we're planning on doing a live stream, like, full spoiler version of our game. I actually played it with Tiffany Kyrez, the one tar. We did a spoiler version of the game one on her live stream, and then we're going to do a 13 now with our completed board. We're going to play a full game with all the rules and all of the stuff. So
that's really cool.
I'm super excited to do that. We had a really good time.
What would you say is like the core element of the game that like just worked so well for you? Because Charterstone is a little bit of a complicated beast for me. I didn't have the same issues that you were mentioning that other people were having as far as like the narrative. And again, I won't go into spoilers here. And even my review that I posted, which I did get a review copy of the game, I should mention that before I start just like diving into all this Charterstone and act like I'm obfuscating some illicit connection to Stonemaier Games or something. But with Charterstone, I think for me, ultimately, I felt like there were two really, really great games, and the combination of those two elements, like the legacy element and the sense of discovery that you're constantly having, and then the competitive, lightweight Euro game that's mm-hmm. in it, somehow didn't work as well as they could have apart for me. And that was my main takeaway. Like, I had fun. I enjoyed it. I'm glad that I played it. But there was an excellent game that was somehow made a little bit too muddy by having too much going on for our tastes. But the worker placement action that you were talking about, the My First Worker Placement, I loved the worker displacement where you're constantly bumping workers. Yep. The core mechanic of the game is incredible and feels so frenetic and electric as you're just constantly bumping people off of places and reaping the rewards. It kind of turns worker placement on its head. So there are some things I love about it.
The worker placement part is actually, I like the tempo-based worker placement, which is the way I would describe it. It's similar to a mechanic that Jamie used in a previous game, Euphoria,
right,
where your workers are allowed to bump other workers off, and that's one of the ways that placement works in the game. Mm-hmm. It also has a little bit of Manhattan Project to it, where you're placing your workers and then recalling your workers, and not everybody is on the same cycle. And that leads to some really interesting moments in the game where you're trying to decide, I really want to use this location, but I don't want to give this person a worker back because that means they won't have to waste a turn recalling their workers. So do I try to press my luck and do other things waiting around for that, or do I just go ahead and bite the bullet because it will slow me down too much to try to slow them down? And it's an interesting question in the game that isn't like standard worker placement where, oh, he took that spot, it's blocked from me, guess I better find another thing to do.
Yeah, well, I find that by the end, when you've filled up the board a little bit more, which I don't think is a spoiler because it's very obvious as soon as you crack open the board that there are places for additional buildings where they're going to go, very obvious slots, that it just felt like most of the spaces I could care less about. And I think that's what my ultimate hang up was, is that I didn't feel like the board was full of possibilities, or maybe it was full of too many possibilities, so many that I couldn't be bothered to care about them because I could only incorporate so many elements into my strategy that I just had to go, this is my designated loop for this game, and maybe there's some stuff going on over on the other end of the board. I can't think about that while also thinking about what I got going on over here.
And I can see that as a totally valid critique. I feel that the game does a really good job of introducing elements in a manner that's easily digestible.
Right.
So it doesn't throw everything in the kitchen sink at you at once. I think that's the strength of the legacy mechanism inside of it. But by the end of the game, like the last four games or so in the 12-game series, like from Game 8 onward, everything's pretty much full. You've got a gigantic selection of options at your disposal, and I could see that that could be overwhelming. I think one of the things that makes that work for me in the game is that because the goal of each game changes, the loop that you care about is a different loop.
Right.
So Like, I wasn't able to just continually spam the same loop over and over again. I had to look at the new end conditions and go, okay, what's my loop this time? Mm-hmm. And it created different decisions. So I feel like there was a lot on the board, and it may have been able to be, like, streamlined a bit and shrunk down.
Right.
But they would have had to shrink the scope of the game itself as well. Like,
totally. So, and I think that's just a preference type of thing. And mm-hmm. again, there's so many elements about the game that I really liked. And mm-hmm. I think that in my heart of hearts, I want a shrunk down, like, 20 space version of Charterstone that plays in only an hour and is kind of like game 4 or game 5 with about mm-hmm. half the things unlocked, and you just have an extremely approachable, extremely tight worker placement game that just has that tempo that you were mentioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so maybe it's because I saw excellence in what I wish could have been that I somehow just didn't like the final product as much. But then again, I mean, this is all like critique kind of stuff where you're like, you know, like, oh, this game was only great. It wasn't perfect.
Yeah, right. And that's kind of where I was with it. I think the biggest thing for me is that it was really ambitious as a project.
Right.
And as a game designer who looks at most of the legacy games that are out there. Like, the only other competitive legacy game that I'm really aware of is Seafall. Mm-hmm. And having played Seafall and having played this felt like a much tighter game than Seafall.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
It also felt like it was trying to do a lot less as far as different things mm-hmm. inside of it. Like, Seafall was a bit of a grab bag. We're going to do a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of everything under the sun. And I feel like it maybe was so ambitious that it got away from design and development. Eventually, they just had to call it done.
Right.
Charterstone feels like the design and development on it was done, but I can see that it wouldn't be to everyone's taste. Like, some of the critiques, like I said, some people feel that the narrative isn't as strong as it could be, and that's totally valid. You're not reading paragraphs out of a book. There's not a large, like, novel-length story unfolding as you play. There is a story, there is a narrative, and there is a, like, and it directly involves the players, but it may not be as big or grandiose in the number of words it contains.
Well, either way, it's something that people should definitely check out, and it's got a lot of really ambitious and cool things going for it, as you mentioned. But you also mentioned as a designer, and that's what I really want to talk about, is the designer, Tony Miller, because the Kickstarter for Fire in the Library is just about to happen. It's right around the corner. You're mm-hmm. on the precipice. How are you feeling about that, dude?
Super excited and crazy nervous.
I can imagine.
It's like a giant swirling emotional ball right now as far as things go. Like, I haven't been here before. Luckily, my publisher, Carla and Nick at Weird Giraffes, they've been here twice before. So they have a much clearer picture of how it's going to be and the way things are going to work. And I'm not, like, walking into this completely on my own. But it's still one of those uncharted territories for me. So it's really exciting to see all the steps being taken towards it, though.
This podcast will go up during the campaign. So in case anyone is listening to this and hasn't heard of Fire in the Library, first off, go to Kickstarter, check it out. And also, if that's not enough to convince you, why don't we talk about, like, for context, what is Fire in the Library? I think last podcast we talked about the theme of you're competitively rescuing books from a fire in said library, but what's mm-hmm. actually the structure of the game for the audience here?
So, Fire in the Library is a game for 1 to 6 players. It has a solo mode that my wonderful publisher has helped create and add to the game as it existed. So that's something that is available for all you solo game players like myself. But it plays up to 6. It's a pressure luck game. And it's a pressure luck game that has a few differences from a lot of other pressure luck games. So in the game, you have a bag, and inside that bag are various cubes. Those cubes are different colors. Anything that isn't red is good. It's a book. You want to rescue it because that's points. Anything that is red is fire. Fire is bad. That kind of goes without saying. Don't find fire if you can. On your turn, you'll basically be drawing cubes from the bag to try to acquire books and avoid fire. There are a couple of wrinkles to this, though. It's not just the luck of pulling cubes from a bag. First of all, the turn order is variable every turn. So whoever has the least amount of points gets to choose how they want to proceed into the library, whether they want to be really brave and charge in, or whether they want to be a little bit more cautious and let other people take the risks. So each turn order actually has a separate card that has a number of spaces that's your carrying capacity, basically, for books. It kind of measures the amount of books you can grab in the time that you're racing into a burning building. Some of those spaces are safe spaces, some of them are risky spaces. Safer spaces give you a little bit more leeway as far as how much fire you're allowed to draw before you bust on your turn. Risky spaces pay a little bit more. You're a little bit more brave, and so you earn a little bit more points. Thematically, it's the first person who charges into the library is going to notice things like collapsed stairs or doorways that are blocked. And ostensibly, they're going to call that out or bring it to the attention of the other people who are following behind them. So they're taking more risks initially, and that's a little bit risky. Obviously, if you're taking risks, it's risky. But they're taking more risks with their run-in, and so they're compensated with bravery points. The reason why you would want to go in earlier and riskier, other than some additional points, is that the game ends immediately when the library collapses. So anytime someone busts, any of the books that you drew prior to drawing the fire that ends your turn, all of those books, sections of the library will burn that correspond to those books. So if you have a purple, a black, and a yellow book, each section of the library, purple, yellow, and black, will burn. Those books will be a little bit more valuable going forward. They'll actually increase in value, and additionally, more fire may be thrown into the bag.
Will there be moments where you are strategically wanting to bust in order to make, like, your reserve? Like, if you have all of the purple and you're like, you know, if I actually bust on this run into the library, it's going to make all my purple cubes that much more valuable. Is that, like, a consideration that a player could reasonably make in the game?
Yes, and that's where the second strategic piece comes in, and that's tools. So, you are a human being, and like all human beings, you are...
You can't prove that.
Well, that's true. But the librarians you're playing in the game are humans, and they are tool-using primates. They have this ability to use tools to help them out. Nobody just runs into a burning building without anything to help them. Most of the time. So the tools that you have at your disposal are going to give you special abilities that help you mitigate risks or change the circumstances of your probabilities. One of the tools is the lockbox. And on the lockbox, you can take one of the books that you scored and you can place it on that. And then at the end of the game, you'll score it again. So as you said, one of the things that you might want to do is, okay, I'm now scoring purple books at the end of the game. I want them to be as valuable as possible. Let's burn some purple books. And occasionally that won't work out. You just will suddenly magically not be able to draw fire, and instead you'll score a whole bunch of points from rescuing other books, and oh well, hopefully you're not too upset by that. But there's the... The tools allow you to kind of vary your strategy. Like, a set of gloves makes it so that all of your spaces are safe spaces, rather than any of them being risky. So now you can go earlier in the turn without the inherent risk involved in going earlier in the turn. And each tool kind of has its own special ability. So managing your turn order and managing your tools is kind of how you mitigate the inherent luck of the pressure luck game.
You know... One of the things that strikes me about this is the opportunity to think about what these books are, and are the different cubes, are they different genres of books? Like, have you gone so far as thinking thematically about that? Is there a way to infuse some more of that into the game? I mean, right now, the other big library game that's out there is Ex Libris. And in that, they did the fantastic job of having each book have a name on it. And
those titles are absolutely amazing. I could just sit there and read the cards all day long.
Totally. And and outside of that, your game has zero in common with Ex Libris, but that is one of the gems of pure thematic, thematic brilliance that Ex Libris has that is so fun when a board game nails that. And I'm wondering, what are some ways that you injected theme into Fire in the Library?
The sections of the library where the different books come from are different genres. So purple is a genre, yellow is a genre, black is a genre. I actually can't remember what the final names for them are in the rule book, but they do all have genres. Like, one is fiction, one is science, one is math, like that. Mm-hmm. And the different wings of the library, the different sections of the library that will be burning down, house those specific types of books, like a library would be organized. One of the problems we ran into when designing it is, initially my concept was to use chipboard books and actually have them be illustrated with titles and everything, so when you're pulling them out, that's the way it works. But it's important tactilely for more emphasis.
Not tactically, but tactilely.
Yes, that they are not different, that they don't feel different.
Right.
And it's much harder to distinguish wooden cubes than it can be to distinguish punched-out chipboard. We tested with some different punched-out chipboard, just random punch-outs from games that we saved, like the generic bits that you normally throw away. We actually played with Potion Explosion punch-outs once.
Okay.
And there were ways of telling, like, okay, I've seen that this one has this to it. I can now draw this out of the bag every time if I want to. And so that led to, a conflict, because initially we wanted to inject that theme of all of the books being interesting as far as individually titled and unique books. In practice, it ended up actually working better to just use cubes.
Is Beth Sobel doing the artwork for this?
Yes.
Yeah, that's crazy. How over the moon were you when Carlo was like, hey, yo, you know, incredible artist behind, like, Viticulture? Yeah, she's doing this.
So Beth is an absolutely dear person. And I met her at BGG Con, not last year, but the year before that. And I met her and I did the normal fanboy gush thing and absolutely, like, fell in love with how just personable she is in general. So this year at BGG Con, I had just gotten there. We'd set all our stuff down. She taught me Medici the Card Game, which is a fantastic game. I highly recommend that one, too, if you like card games. Anyway, we were sitting there and waiting for everything to kind of start, and she's like, so do you have anything? And I said, well, I have, you know, my little pressure luck game, Fire in the Library. And she goes, sure, let's try that. So we sat down and we played it, and at the end of it, she's like, And she turns to her husband and she says, would I have room in my schedule for this?
Oh,
and
man.
At this point, like, my jaw is on the floor. Like,
see, I figured that Carla worked that out, but it came from her playtesting your game here.
Carla is the absolute boss. So, like, my final response, once her and Daniel hashed it out as far as whether or not there was room in her schedule for another game, was, okay, you need to contact Carla, she's the boss, or I'll have Carla contact you, what works best for you, because having Beth illustrate one of my games is a bucket list item for me. Like, it's that level of amazing. Like, I've seen the quality of work that she brings in various other places, like you said, Viticulture, her illustrations for Sunset Over Water are mm-hmm. some of the most gorgeous landscape settings I've ever seen in my life. You know, I follow her and watch all of her 1 hour studies that she does, wherein she creates artwork that I couldn't create given a lifetime in an hour. And so she's definitely somebody that was on my radar. Never did I imagine, never, not once in my entire existence, did I imagine that my first game would have artwork that looked like this good.
How cool is it that artists are now getting recognition within board games as well, that not just designers, like that already was kind of a thing that happened over maybe the last 10 years or so, that designers were getting recognition and getting their names on the boxes, but now artists are also a draw. You know, the thing that came to my mind as soon as I saw the announcement of Beth Sobel was doing this game was, of course, Viticulture, which is a Stonemaier game that I love. Like, that's an incredible game. And a huge part of that is the visuals and the immersive representation of everything that paired with the mechanics creates this awesome resonance. And she's great at capturing the essence of something. And there are other artists in this industry. Quan Chai Moria is another yes. one that he's becoming more and more prolific and doing all these different types of games and all kinds of different styles, yet it's still true to his form. And he has a great way of bringing out what the essence of a game is. And I'm elated, especially as a comic book guy, to see that artists are starting to get more and more recognition for what they bring to a game.
Every game takes a village to produce. Like, the designer's name, or in this case designers, myself and my co-designer John Prather, may be on the box, the publisher's logo may be on the box, but the publisher, the artist, the graphic designer, the playtesters, the designers themselves, the developers, like the number of people involved in producing a game is, you know, like us, it's a group of people. It's not one person. There's not one individual mind behind it. And I think that's one of the strengths of board games as compared to some other medium. That are more individual driven. It's very much, it's very exciting to me personally. Like my podcast, Breaking Into Board Games, we interview people from all over the industry. And funnily enough, you brought up Quan Chai. By the time this airs, our episode with Quan Chai will have aired. We just interviewed him earlier this week. All of these people are contributing something. You know, Beth is doing amazing artwork for my game. Katie Cow, the graphic designer, has blown me away with how she took my initial, like, Excel spreadsheet clip art nonsense and turned it into something that's very clear and very obvious and, like, that people can just sit down and play. And that's a skill that a graphic designer has that me as a designer could, like, hope to one day develop, but not, I don't come with that inherently. I need these people for my dream to become real. You know, Carl and Nick, obviously, like, as the publishers, as the developers, they're mandatory as well. You know, the game doesn't actually make it to Kickstarter without Carla's hustle, without Nick figuring out all of the financial sides of things and, you know, them building all of the reviewer copies in their living room and sending them out. Like, it's very humbling to be involved in this whole process, because while it's great to have something that I created out in the world, it's really a completely collaborative effort, and it's become something that we created out into the world. Like, my initial ownership of it is only a fraction of what you guys will eventually have in your hands. And
this is a good point to bring up a Twitter question that we got. That was, what are some of the ways, oh, I should say, Chris Anderson at BlueCubeBGS on Twitter asks, what are some of the ways Fire in the Library changed throughout the design process and at Weird Giraffe's development, that being Weird Giraffe Games?
So this game changed a whole bunch. every game goes through iterations. Like, there's no game that emerges fully formed from someone's head. And some of those changes are minor changes, graphic design changes, clarity changes, stuff like that. Some of them are major changes. You know, when this game started, it had a board. It does not now. It didn't have tools when the game started. Then it had only buckets as a tool you got whenever you busted. Then we added a few tools, and now we have 10 unique tools in the game, and even more that have been dreamed up. Like, the initial version of the game that we playtested was a hand-drawn grid on a sheet of paper on a hotel bed in Unpubs, in the hotel we were staying at for an Unpub. And it was just me showing a whole bunch of other people, like, hey, here's this thing that John and I came up with. What do you guys think? And we played it a whole bunch of iterations back to back to back to back and kept changing things. And that just kind of continued for 2 years now. So when we finally got to Carla, we had a pretty solid game, but there were still some things that didn't work for us. It's like, we have this problem. Carla, you're a designer in your own right. You're also a developer for this title. You know, what can you do? And one of the first things that she did was just drastically increase the number of tools and then make them all more individual. It was much easier to brainstorm with her. Like, by the time she had signed it, John and I were so close to the design that we were having problems coming up with additional abilities. Now, we had a list, but we didn't have nearly as many as we do now. And she helped innovate a lot of that into the design. She created the solo mode for the game. I mentioned that a little bit earlier, but the solo version of the game is her. Like, we built it so that a solo version could be added, like, could be part of it. But she figured out how to have the AI work, which was really, really cool to watch and cool to playtest and give her feedback. It was really neat to be able to playtest my own game. All of these familiar...
it's got to be a little surreal, too.
Yes, all of these familiar components, playing them in a slightly different way as a solo game. And it was really, really great to go through that experience. The solo mode is beastly. It is mean.
Good. That's what I like hearing, is that I want a good challenge out of my solo mode.
Yeah, and I think that's great. Like, I love the fact that it's going to take something to beat the AI. Like, she worked really hard to make sure that it wasn't just a cakewalk or a bolt-on. And that makes me very, very happy, because I know how much people care about having solo modes in their games these days. Ex Libris, you mentioned earlier, has a fantastic solo mode. So it was one of those things that I was really happy to see. I don't even know what version of the game this version is.
8003.
Yeah, it's like that. I will say that we were iterating like every quarter at a minimum, like every 3 months, like overhauling everything and reprinting brand new prototypes and starting from there, with incorporating all the changes that we'd made. Once Carla signed it, we were iterating at least once or twice every week.
That is insane.
For the first month.
That is crazy. But well, Carla awesome. Is like a playtest fiend, making sure that people are signing up and just doing blind playtests, doing public playtests, like doing all kinds of playtests. And she's great about documenting that. That's something that I highly recommend, that anyone who's on Twitter and is interested in this kind of stuff, follow Carla. If nothing else, she is so good at documenting what challenges she's going through right now, as well as like what successes she's had and what are the new events in her board gaming life that are going on, whether it's putting together prototypes in her car or it's announcing that, hey, Beth Sobel is going to be doing the artwork on this. Like, there's all kinds of cool stuff that is really uplifting and encouraging as a creative person on her feed.
And it's super fun because I was putting out data from my side and she was putting out data from her side. And then we were at night getting together and talking over each other's notes. Like while I was at BGGCon playing Fire in the Library with Beth, she was at PAX Unplugged because it was the same weekend in the Unpub area, putting my design in front of hundreds of people back to back to back to back.
Including Rob Conley, the producer of this podcast from Ginger Cat Productions. Yeah. He was one of the people playtesting it at PAX Unplugged.
And so I'm like sitting in BGGCon and just seeing an endless stream of pictures of people playing and enjoying my game and retweeting the pictures and making comments about it. And it was a brand new experience for me. Like, cutting components in the car, in the back seat of the car, is something that Carla just does. She'll regularly be going to an event like a convention and finishing up her prototypes en route while someone else drives. Mm-hmm. I just want to clarify that. But she's posted pictures of that before for her games and her designs. And it was very surreal to one day wake up on a Saturday morning and to see images of my cards on her paper cutter in her back seat.
Totally.
It was just one of those like, oh my gosh, this is really real. Like, this is really happening. There are people other than me playing my game. There are people, like, I'm not supervising these playtests directly. My baby is out in the world walking on its own now.
Well, so, your partnership, co-design baby, because you have a co-designer. It's
yes.
So what was that like? Did you two come up with the idea together just sitting around talking about something, or did one of you have the germ of an idea that you brought to the other?
John is the yin to my yang. John is the
peanut butter to your chocolate.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Although I'm the one who gets stuck in your mouth a little easier. John,
I don't know how I feel about that, Tony.
John is... John is the math guy. John is super smart. He's been gaming like since he's been born, as far as I can tell. He's really into abstracts and economic games and really like whipcrack smart dude. And we met each other at a local board game group in Kentucky, and both of us had interests in design. And I was actually working on my first design, which was completely my own. And it wasn't getting anywhere. But we're both gearheads, and so we just both started talking to each other regularly about game design. I can talk about games and game design indefinitely, like literally until tomorrow morning. If that was an option, we could be on this same call having discussions about games and game design.
Totally.
John is like that. I'm a designer who designs in conversation. Like, I think better when I'm talking and when I'm listening to other people talk than I do when I'm sitting in front of a blank book or I'm sitting in front of an empty document on a computer screen. John is similar. Both of us have tons of game ideas, like notebooks and notebooks full of ideas. So we have a lot of designs. Back to Earth is also a co-design. Stocko Trucks, which I'm bringing to Unpub, is also a co-design. Like, John and I get along like a house on fire, or in this case, a library on fire. But, but the big key, the thing that really started it all is that both of us were looking for someone else to interact with on the game design aspects of gaming,
right?
Not just the game playing aspects of gaming. And as soon as we found each other, it just like clicked. Like, we just got each other nearly instantly. And so Fire in the Library started as my thing. Like, I came up with the initial mechanism. Who doesn't like pulling things from a bag? I mean, seriously, I love it. And then
I have dogs, so not always do I like pulling things from a bag.
Fair enough. And then I kind of had this mechanism, and then I had this theme, this meme-inspired theme about how angry I was that the Library of Alexandria had burned down and all those that had lost. And So I was sitting there, and I was on a long road trip with my wife, and we were just talking, and we talk a lot about game design on long road trips because it's one of my primary interests, and she indulges me. I was just talking, like, I really want to do a pressure luck game. I love pressure luck games. I have this awesome mechanism in mind wherein not only are you drawing these things from a bag, but the value of them changes over the course of the game based on the actions of the players. And, like, I really want to do this, but I can't think of a theme. Like, anything that I think of is a little bit too dark. Like, rescuing people is, like, if you fail, that's really heavy. Like, what's something that, like, is really important and that you would love to rescue, but if you don't, the world doesn't end? Like, there's no tragedy. Like, there's a tragedy, but it's, you know, not on the same level.
It's not like you're playing Escape the Underground Railroad game.
Exactly.
That game is an incredible game, but is a little too grim and a little too real when you start losing in that.
But at the same time, the mechanisms in that game kind of match the weight. And this was like a little pressure luck game. To add some heavy theme on top of it was really a mismatch and really didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's the one who kind of planted the seed in my mind of, well, what about, you know, a library? What about books? Books are important to you. If a book burns, yeah, it sucks, but like, nobody's going to feel like the world has ended. Like, it'll be something that you will feel, but not sting in that way. And so I'm like, oh, well, crap, yeah. So, like, as soon as that road trip was over, I got on the Google Hangout with John, and I'm like, so here's the idea. How do we make this happen? And then we just sat out plotting everything, like brainstorming. We had like a 2-hour conversation where we brainstormed how this was going to work and what it was going to look like and all this stuff. And so then we go to Unpub, and I don't bring any printed prototypes or anything with me, just the ideas that we had brainstormed. And so we get to the hotel room, and Ian Zhang, who's also on my podcast, was sharing the room with us. And we get there early, and he's like, getting to conventions early, I'm just going to put this out there for designers, getting to conventions early is a really good way to find time to just kind of mess around with designs. You know, this is how you have Beth Sobel play your game while you're waiting around for everything to start, or how you...
Everyone in the world is maybe lining up for Beth Sobel to be like, hey, you want to just casually play my prototype here? I totally know you're going to do the artwork for it now, right?
I'm sorry, Beth. Not my intent, but, like... It's that time before a convention starts is time that people are just kind of looking to kill time. And so that's all it was. Ian was just like, well, let's play something. We're here. Let's play a prototype. And so I went to grab the prototype that I was going to be showing all weekend. And he goes, no, you're going to be playing that all weekend. Show me something like nitty and gritty and brand new. Show me something like that's not even close to done. And I was like, okay, well, I didn't bring any of the components, but here. And I ripped a sheet of paper off of the hotel notebook and drew what we had designed on it and set it on the hotel bed, and then scavenged components from various other games that we had brought with us to, like, play the first version of Fire in the Library.
That's awesome.
We played it for, like, 2 hours straight. Maybe 3 hours straight, just like playing a couple rounds and then iterating and then playing a couple rounds and then iterating. Like, none of us cared if we finished the game. Nobody was there trying to win anything. We were just trying to take this seed of an idea and make it work. And by the end of that, John and I had a very clear idea of how we wanted Fire in the Library to be. Iteration from that point forward was just kind of refining the experience.
It sounds like you're such a collaborative person and you enjoy the team process. You know, you were speaking to earlier how it takes a village in order to make a game. Do you have any aspirations? Like, is it a goal of yours to eventually release a game that is a solo design? Or is that not even, like, you couldn't care less? You just care about working with great people to make great games. Doesn't matter if you are a solo designer on it.
No, it really doesn't matter to me. Like, I'm not in it for the, like, rock star acclaim.
All that Rockstar acclaim that comes with board game design.
Well, Eric Lang, basically, one of the pieces of advice he gives to designers is decide what kind of designer you are. What is it that you really care about? Because, you know, game design has a couple of different directions you can go. If you want to make money, you're largely going to be working on contract for existing IPs, creating things for other people based on other people's ideas. That's a totally legit way to exist in the game design space, and some people thrive on that. But if you aren't that type of game designer, you may not enjoy that. Some people do it because they want to be rock stars. Eric has said that this is his big thing. Like, he wants to be a rock star game designer. Like, he wants people to know, this is a game, I designed it, it's awesome. You know, like, that's his primary motivation, is that. Like, he wants the recognition, and that's not a bad thing. That's just his motivation for doing it. Me, I want people to play my games. I'm the creative type. I'm out here to share a particular experience with people. Like, I want people, through playing my games, to feel something that I feel. Whether that's, you know, overt in message or content or theme, or more covert in, you know, I really like risk mitigation as a thing. Like, I love pressure luck games, and I like things that allow me to kind of mitigate risk and make those decisions of how crazy am I? Like, how far do I want to take this? So being able to create something with that kind of tension and give it to other people to play is my real motivation.
Totally.
At this point, like, the Kickstarter going up and funding and getting the game in everyone's hands is just a means to an end for me personally. Like, seeing Carla have my game in front of hundreds of people at a major convention was already a major win for me, because that's my game, my design, my thoughts, my feelings, like, out in the world, and that's kind of what I want. A successful Kickstarter is the dream, because now my reach is so much further. It's so much more expanded by interacting with and working with everybody else. Like, there's my group of people that want to support me, Carla's group of people that want to support her, John's, Beth's, like, all of these people whose lives I'm now touching and interacting with through my game design. So that's my personal motivation behind it. So, would I love to do a singular design someday that's, you know, Tony Miller only on the box? I wouldn't be adverse to it. I think it's a cool thing. I think it would be cool just to try, but I don't feel compelled to do that. Like, if I never release a game that isn't a co-design with John or someone else, that would be fine by me, because all games are already collaborative efforts, whether there's somebody else on the designer byline or not.
Totally. Yeah, I can relate to that. That's I think about a lot of things in musical terms, and I'm mm-hmm. one of those guys who's like a multi-instrumentalist. You know, I have more instruments than any human being should really have. But ultimately, I don't really like being the Bex of the world, you mm-hmm. know, playing every instrument on your own album mm-hmm. and then having this isolated auteur thing that you put out into the world. Mm-hmm. To me, it is all about the collaboration with other mm-hmm. artists and other creative people. Very much a getting into the groove and creating something that is only in existence by all of our own creative mm-hmm. energies and ideologies and histories meshing mm-hmm. together and producing something unique to that collaboration. And that, to me, is where the magic happens.
Oh yeah. I'm happy to be part of the band. Like, I'll show up and play lead guitar. I'll sing, I'll do the bass, you know, whatever it is that we need to do, or whatever needs to happen to produce the final song or the concert or whatever it is that we're working on. But, you know, there's no need for me to have my name. Like, I'm happy having a band name on the front of my CD and not my personal name. That's totally cool with me.
Totally. Well, I think we can talk about Fire in the Library ad nauseum, but I did want to hit another Twitter question that we had here, which is like a Twitter compliment slash question. This is by a very awesome dude who I know that you know. This is Rick Lorenzen, who has recently been at SaltCon and showing off his game, a very cool designer, and he was asking on Twitter, actually, you know what? He gives a two-part here, and I'm going to start with the second part, so that way we can get the mushy compliment out of the way. And he says,
sure.
Two, not really a question, but Tony, you've contributed in so many ways to this community, and it's so inspiring to see how many people in the industry and community have rallied around you and your Fire in the Library game. Seems like it's all coming back to you 100-fold, and you deserve it all. Can you just bask in that compliment for a second and be like, yes, I deserve this. This is awesome.
That's incredibly hard for me to do. And that's one of the things that I've kind of been dealing with as we've gotten closer to the Kickstarter, as we're approaching it. And when you're listening to this, as we're in the middle of it, is being like seeing how far my reach has expanded, seeing how many lives I've touched and how many people have been interacted with. One of the things we're going to be doing in the Kickstarter is we're actually offering a tier where you can get yourself a copy of the game and then also donate a copy to a library that has a game library.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's one of those things like that I personally care a lot about how I impact other people. And we talked in part one of our conversations earlier, my opinions on the human race and how much I love people. You know, I didn't set out to make all of the contributions that I've made in order to get stuff back. I set out to do it because a lot of it wasn't there when I started. You know, there were a couple of game design podcasts that were out there. There were some people collecting resources for designers. Some of them didn't have large enough spotlights shined on them, in my opinion. You know, Cardboard Edison has been doing this for years, aggregating data for game designers to help people get into the industry and actually understand what it is they're getting into, both the business side and the design side. You know, Board Game Design Lab more recently, Ludology. Like, there's all these people out there who are helping people. And when I started, it was a smaller number. And now I'm among those. Like, I'm the game design ambassador from my podcast. Like, game designers reach out to me because when I introduce myself, I'm Tony Miller and I'm a board game designer. You know, we have someone else filling the publisher role, someone else filling the developer role. And it's just been great to be able to interact with the community and see other people take off. So all of that has been fantastic. And I really feel the love coming back from people. The number of people who've wanted to talk to me, which is still weird, and wanted to interview me is still a weird occurrence. For me personally, has been great. I posted earlier today, you know, I have over 2,000 followers on Twitter, and it still shocks me that people want to listen to what I have to say. so it's, you know, it's just one of those things like, okay, yeah, why not?
I think it comes down to that you are someone who wants to contribute and you want to be able to give something back to the world that you feel honored to be a part of. And in spite of any sort of craziness in the world, in spite of any sort of darkness in the world, you are someone who sees that you still have a choice, and every human being still has a choice, no matter how small your sphere is, you can still make the choice to bring some light into the world. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is what compels me to talk to you, because mm-hmm. I don't always make that right choice, but mm-hmm. that's something that I very much aspire to. And to have enjoyment and light and beauty in the world, even when I'm sometimes feeling at my most dark. And so I think that's what's at the core of Rick's compliment here, is mm-hmm. that you have given so much joy and love and affection towards everyone else for all of their successes, and it sounds like it's really coming back to you, and you deserve it because, you know, the love you take is equal to the love you make. The Beatles said it. That's all there is to it.
And it's humbling and it's wonderful, guys. Like, it really is. Again, this is before the Kickstarter is even active, and I already feel how much the community has reached out. It's been really awesome. So regardless of where we go from here, if you're listening to this, absolutely. I love the heck out of you. So,
and I'm listening to you talking right now, so I feel the love right now. But yeah, let's get to Rick's question here. So, Tony, with all your connections in the game community, I imagine you've had opportunities to get feedback on your designs from other successful designers and people in the industry. What were those experiences like? What did you gain from such pro feedback? And given that we have a bit of a schedule, let's narrow it down to like the top one or two things that really were paradigm shifts or aha moments that affected you on a fundamental level as a designer.
Okay. I have three specific ones that I'm going to bring up, and they kind of were course adjustments for me as a designer and in this crazy design world that I was in. So the first one is Nate Murray, who is on Twitter. I don't remember Nate's handle, unfortunately, off the top of my head, but he used to work for IDW in the games division. He still works for IDW in a different part of the company. He was one of the first people to really like say, you know, hey, this is a really good design and it deserves to be in a box on a shelf somewhere. For one of my games, in this case, my beat 'em up card game, which still isn't in a box on a shelf somewhere, but like, he was the first person to just flat out say in a pitch meeting, hey, this is great, and it deserves to exist in the world for other people to share. He kind of started a relationship with me, mentor to mentee, because he was very much on the business side, very familiar with the publishing side of things and the realities of how does a game become a product. And he really opened my eyes to, these are all of the things that you're thinking about making a good game. Publishers are thinking about making a good product. And though that's a Venn diagram that has a lot of overlap, but it's not one circle. There are some things that will make a game better that can kill it as a product and vice versa. And so he very quickly gave me a crash course in the difference between designing games to design games and designing games for publication. And that was like just one of the most valuable experiences I've ever had. Number two is I was at BGGCon, and I was hanging out with a whole bunch of other designers and awesome people, and we decided to go sit down in the hotel bar and have a snack and just hang out for a little while. And in walks Rob Davio and sits down at our table.
Talk about rock star, you know, like Keith Richards coming in, sitting down next to you.
Rob is one of the most personable people I have ever met in my life. Like, he's down to earth. He's legit. Like, he walked over and sat at the table with the other game designers because he considers himself a peer. Like, he's another game designer. And we had a conversation talking about being a game designer and getting into the industry and the competitiveness between game designers, and how, like, everybody is so supportive. Everybody points, like, if I play a game that somebody else has designed and I think there's a publisher that would be a good fit, I tell that person, and vice versa. Like, when people play my games, they give me recommendations of, hey, you should take this and put it in front of so-and-so because this is something that they would like. And we were just talking about how it's an industry where there's just not that competitiveness, but at the same time, there's only so many spots. Like, yes, the number of games keeps growing every year, like the number of games released, but it's still competitive. And like, in the game design world, to really get attention, like, when I put a design out there, it is competing with Eric Lang's designs, with Rob Davio's designs, with Jamie Stegemeyer's designs. Like, it's not, I don't exist on a separate tier. Like, there's not the major leagues and the JV league designers. We're all designers. And to hear that, like, him just looking at me and very earnestly tell me, like, stop thinking of yourself as the B team. We're all the A team. There is no B team.
That's awesome. Like,
all of us are designers, and all of us are going to have games that are going to be hits, and all of us are going to have games that are going to be flops, and that's just part of the process. And because we're such a community that we help each other, that we'll be here for each other for the flops, and we'll help each other celebrate the successes, and we're all going to get through it together. And it was just... it's one of those moments where one of your, like, heroes shows up in real life and proves that he actually has the costume on underneath the button-up shirt. And it was just – it was an amazing experience that just kind of shifted my whole perspective of, you know what? I need to start treating my designs like I am the A-team. Like, I'm not riding the bench. I'm not filling in the gaps that the big league designers aren't paying attention to. Like, I'm right. designing games for people the same way they are. And it made a huge difference in my mindset in how I approached games. And then the third one, the final one I'm going to bring up is Chris Rollins and Maddie Christensen. 1000 XP Games is how they're better known. They released a game on Kickstarter last year called The Last Garden. And they did this themselves as a brand new publisher, like, jumped in with both feet to take this on and become a game design studio, effectively, and a publisher. Interacting with them, as they started going through this process of figuring it all out and seeing what they did and the hustle and everything, Chris actually said something. Chris, I don't know if any of you guys know, had a background in the hip-hop scene before he did game design stuff. And one of the things he was talking about is how in hip-hop, when somebody spits mad fire, that's not discouraging to other people in hip-hop. That's a driving force. It's now my job to be better than that person was. Like, that's a challenge. They've laid down a gauntlet, but it's a friendly gauntlet. It's not a slap in the face. It's not an attack on me. It's
almost like improv comedy. It's a yes and.
Yes. This guy has just upped the game across the board for everyone. So now what are you coming with?
It's providing someone a platform in order to return. It's like wrestling being the heel, so that way you can let the babyface come in and save the day.
Oh, thank you for bringing the wrestling analogy in. Exactly that. Like, I'm going to put it out there to make you all better. And one of the things, like, he said to me as he was doing all of this is he's like, you know, iron sharpens iron. You know, you aren't going to get better at any of this stuff without putting yourself out there and taking risks. And it's terrifying as hell. And he, like, just confided in me, like, you know, I question whether I know what I'm doing every day, taking a game, publishing it, and putting it out there. That's just the way life is. But if you don't take any risks, you never get anywhere. You can stay in your room, comfortable, with no worries. You're not going to get anywhere doing that.
Right.
And, you know, him and Maddie have gone on to become some of my dearest friends in the board game industry, and they're always motivating me. They're always motivating other people. And, you know, all of the games that they release now, I see, like, other games that other designers release as challenges. Like, not only are game designers pulling for me and I'm competing with them, but now it's, okay, do better than this. You know, Jamie Stegemeyer drops Charterstone on the world, and now all other legacy game designers are on notice. Follow that up. And that's, you know, it's a totally freeing attitude for me to look at the industry, because I have no malice towards the other designers in this industry. I'm not looking to take their spots. Like, I don't even think that's a thing that exists in this industry, which is one of the reasons I love it. But having that external motivation of, well, crap, I've got to up my game now if I'm going to compete. I've got to get better. They're all getting better. They're all running harder and training harder and working harder. I've got to up my game now so that I can hang with these guys. And it's been fantastically motivating to be able to do that. So those are three specific examples of people in the industry who've really changed my life as a designer.
Well, that's awesome. And that just ties into the appreciative ethos of the bearded rogue, Tony Miller himself. And I think that's a good spot to end it for today. There's so much more that I want to talk to you about. Fire in the Library is up on Kickstarter right now, if you're listening to this when this podcast drops. And then you got a couple other games coming up that I want to talk to you more about them as they are getting ready to be published. I mean, Back to Earth is another co-design. It was Stucco Trucks.
And yeah, Stucco Trucks.
Stucco Trucks. You're bringing that to Unpub here soon. So you got a lot of cool stuff on the horizon. Tony, where's the best place for people to check you out other than simply the phenomenal podcast that you do, Breaking Into Board Games?
The easiest way to get a hold of me is I'm at Bearded Rogue on Twitter. I am 100% open for communication. I love talking to brand new designers. I love answering questions. It's why I do a podcast on design. And as I said, iron sharpens iron. So brand new designers have as much to contribute. You guys aren't the B team either. Bring your ideas in the industry. We need them, and it's going to make us all better.
I love it. All right, Tony, it's been once again an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As always, the Cardboard Herald is a completely free service focused on spotlighting games, gamers, and game creators. You can find all of our podcasts, including the Cardboard Herald and TCBH Reviews, on iTunes, Stitcher, and our website. For more recommendations and reviews, you can also head over to our YouTube channel. We do not pay to advertise the show, so please continue spreading the word, following, liking, rating, and doing all the social media things. It truly does help us out a ton. If you'd like to drop us a line and maybe have your listener mail read on air, find us on Twitter at Cardboard Herald or send us an email to cardboardherald@gmail.com or click the contact link on our page. Once again, thank you for listening. I've been Jack for the Cardboard Herald, and you keep on gaming. We'll be right back.